Call to order this hearing of the Minnesota Senate Taxes Committee, Thursday, February 29th, at approximately 8:35 a.m. First item on the agenda is adoption of the minutes from February 15th. Are there any corrections? Seeing none, the minutes stand approved as presented. The first bill on our agenda is Senate File 1119, Senator Pratt. And there is this the first? This is the first hearing. This is an author's amendment. Senator Klein moves the A1 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Pratt, welcome to the Senate.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. Senate File 1119 is an idea that's been out there for a while. When we commission nuclear power plants, ratepayers pay into a fund that gets set aside and invested to eventually decommission and close the nuclear plant. Over time, the gains and losses in that trust fund are taxed. And we started thinking about this more like a retirement account than, say, a mutual fund, where those gains should not be taxed. They should be left in the fund to continue to grow. Because it's possible that if the tax draws the fund down to a certain level, ratepayers will be on the hook for making up that difference. So what this bill does is essentially remove the annual tax liability, which has historically been, at least according to Excel, about $4.7 million, which is a little different than we saw in the revenue note this morning, and push that tax out to the point in time when the trust fund is liquidated. That's my very simplistic summary of the bill, and I'll let Mr. Pearson get into the specifics.
Before you do that, Senator Pratt, did you say you had not seen the revenue estimate until this morning?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Well, then I'm going, at some point, I'll ask Ms. Bears to come forward and explain why it's changed. But we'll hear from your witness first. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Pearson. And if you'll identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, members. My name is Jim Pearson. I'm with Xcel Energy, and I'm here this morning to provide a few points of emphasis and hopefully answer questions to the extent members have them. We did work to put a one-pager in member packets. That one-pager is intended to give you a little bit more context. But I did want to just emphasize a couple of things this morning. One, this is a situation where we collect, as Senator Pratt said, money from our customers to ensure that these trusts are adequately funded. So when the time comes where we moved to decommission the three nuclear reactors that we own and operate, there'll be sufficient revenue to do so. We're only allowed to collect that revenue when the plants are in operation. But obviously the money is needed 60 or 70 years beyond the time of plant closure. So there's a front-loaded aspect to how we collect our money, or this money, from our customers. So I think that's an important detail to keep in mind. Essentially what we're asking with this bill is to allow those trusts, which are located out in Pennsylvania, to grow tax deferred. The benefit of allowing them to grow tax deferred goes to our customers. Obviously, if there's more money in those funds, there's less collection that we need to do to ensure that they're properly funded. So it's essentially, that's essentially the point. It's just to allow those to grow tax deferred. And we have worked with some of the organizations that we work with on a lot of different aspects of our business who represent the interests of ratepayers, and there is a letter in your packet sort of emphasizing that point that the allowing them to grow tax deferred is in the benefit of our customers. So I think that's really an important point to remember. And then just emphasizing again what Senator Pratt said, at the point in time where this money rolls or comes back to Xcel Energy to do that decommissioning work, taxes are paid at that time. So it's there is that detail to remember as well. So again, I really just wanted to thank the committee, Senator Pratt, Madam Chair, Senator Weber. I know you've worked on this in the past, so I really appreciate the time this morning and glad to answer any questions if I can.
Mr. Pearson, we don't have Mr. Elwood testifying, but we do have his letter. He indicates in the second paragraph of his letter that the savings to the ratepayers would be in the $20 to $25 million range. Do you concur with that informal estimate?
Madam Chair, yes. So if Senator Pratt's bill were current law, that would be the case. Obviously, as we work to ensure the trusts are appropriately funded, there's a lot of factors that go into the calculation. So the amount of the savings can vary over time. That can vary based on how the funds are performing and how investments are done and in rates of inflation. So there's many factors to it. But again, I do concur with the details in Mr. Elwood's letter there. And again, that's the current state. So how that changes over time, we'll continue to monitor that. But if it were current law, that would be the case.
Mr. Pearson, when was the latest increase in the rates paid by Xcel Energy's customers?
So, Madam Chair, great question. I would have to double
on my bill.
I would have to double check with our tax folks to give you the exact date. We do this every 3 or 4 years. So we are going to be recalculating this at the end of this calendar year in December of 2024. So how that number is going to look or the potential savings, I don't have that as I sit here in front of you today. We would have that information toward the end of the year when we run all of the data and do the work to put that filing together. So the last time it was done, it was about 4 years ago.
And the process is to make a request of the Public Utilities Commission to approve that rate increase, or can you do it on your own?
Madam Chair, another great question. There's very few aspects of our business that we do on our own. That is, this issue goes before the commission. The commission weighs in on whether those trusts are adequately funded. And we also do this work through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So we have a two-step process. Obviously, there's federal oversight in this case as well as state oversight.
And Mr. Pearson, on customers' bills, what are the categories that appear on a bill that lead to their final cost per month or however they pay it?
Madam Chair, that, again, another good question. This particular issue isn't a line item or its own specific category. It's buried into the rate case as a whole, and the rate cases are very detailed and thorough processes. So the typical things that a customer is going to see on their bill would be it's the service charge. It's essentially the monthly, whether you're overhead or underground service. You'll see a rate. So depending on the customer kilowatt hour use, that those kilowatt hours will be multiplied by the rate. And then there will be a fuel charge, which is the summation of all of the fuel that we purchase to run power plants, or if we're buying power from third parties, all of that is rolled through and just directly passed through. Those are the main categories. There are some rate riders. Oftentimes those rate riders are bundled together. So they're not, again, line items, but they're bundled the renewable development account and a number of others are kind of rolled into one rider on the bill. And so if you flip over our bill, there's an explanation of the various line items there that, that hopefully gives the customers a little bit more context about what each of those line items includes.
And what taxes are collected on the bill?
Madam Chair, if you could repeat that, I didn't quite...
The taxes, what kind of tax? Some bills come that have total tax on them. I don't mean the electric bill, but the total tax on them. Some companies or industries or whatever, retailers, itemize the taxes. And what I was just wondering how that's, how the taxes, and I know there's sales tax, how they're reported on the bill so that they, that there's some bit of transparency to your customers.
Sure. Again, wonderful question. So the taxes that Xcel Energy pays as a corporation and these type of taxes is all part of the overall rate case. And so we're projecting forward what those tax liabilities will be, just as we are projecting forward what our costs and so forth, and that's part of that detailed rate case.
No, I'm asking right now, what kind of taxes do you bundle the taxes on a customer's statement that you send to them? Are they itemized? How are they reported currently to a customer, and what kind of programs can they participate in to reduce those the cost, which I assume then is reflected in the tax that is imposed?
So Madam Chair, there is, so organizations like CUB and Legal Aid and others participate in a rate case, so there's that process. On the bill, there is a line item that says state tax or local government tax. That's just a percentage of the total bill. So that would be a tax that is above and beyond some of the issues that we're talking about.
Yes.
With Senator Pratt's bill. That is not based on usage. That's just based on total bill.
On the cost, the price.
On the cost,
yes.
Correct.
That's the answer I was looking for. It's based on the price on the monthly bill that
yes.
they receive. Are there any other questions or comments for Mr. Pearson or Senator Pratt? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your questions were kind of getting to my thoughts too about the transparency of the, if this bill were to pass, the tax relief. And so if I understand, I'm reading these documents correctly, this is about $1 billion in the NDT trust fund now, and you're seeking to have it, rather than paying taxes on that, you're seeking to have it grow tax-free, as Senator Pratt said, much like a retirement account. But my question is, where is the transparency for the tax, for the ratepayers? So I understood you to say that you don't determine those rates, so it'd have to go through the PUC. So we'd have to rely upon the PUC to actually take all of the savings from the tax relief and apply that to the taxpayers. I just don't know how we would monitor that. I don't know how the public would know if the money was actually in the tax savings on $1 billion. That tax savings seems to be maybe four. How much is the tax savings a year are you anticipating?
So, Madam Chair and
Mr.
Senator
Pearson.
Nelson, the tax savings that our customers would benefit or would see is, if this was current law, in our current rates, mm-hmm. would have been about $20 million per year. So as we work to redo the calculation and resubmit this at the end of 2024, we're going to go through, again, a very detailed modeling exercise to look at what our future expenses are going to be, including taxes and including the decommissioning costs, and then look to see what the balances are and what we need to collect from our customers to ensure that all of those liabilities can be met 60 to 70 years out. So as you can see, that is a bit of a challenge. It's somewhat speculative. So what that number will look like as we redo all of these calculations and make assumptions about investment growth, rates of inflation, all sorts of macroeconomic conditions, that is the point of redoing this every 4 years. So as I sit here today, I don't know what that number is going to look like at the end of 2024. That is something that, you know, we'll know as we do that work. But I think your question goes to a much broader and important point is understand, you know, utility rates and the transparency about how those rates are put together, because a rate is there's multitude of factors that go into determining that rate. Rate cases before the Public Utilities Commission generally take about a year and a half or 2 years to settle. So there are multiple parties. It's a litigative, or it's a process that goes before an administrative law judge in many cases. So that broader issue around transparency and utility rates is really a topic of its own. Because yes, to customers, all of the different factors are not necessarily transparent, and that's something we work on day in and day out.
Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the two pieces in my mind that are just still a bit, I would say, frustrating in a sense, but maybe just the fact that we don't have the information that we need. So first of all, basing anything on 60 and 70 year outlook is very speculative is not even the proper word. There's got to be a word that is super speculative. So I don't know how anyone can. So that's a challenge. But the bigger challenge is that lack of transparency. I mean, every business that comes in here would like to have tax relief so that they could reduce the cost to their consumers or to their customers. And this happens to be a very large tax relief. And yet the savings and the decision on how those tax dollars would be spent better than paying the state of Minnesota, paying towards allowing your customers to pay less, the challenge is that decision really isn't, as I understand it, it's not Xcel's decision. The PUC will determine what that rate looks like and how those savings will or will not be adopted. And then how do we the transparency and the lack of transparency on $20 million of tax savings every year is somewhat concerning. And so I'm very interested in holding down the cost of energy. I think that is an important thing for us to look at. There may be other ways to do that in a better way. But so I'm just concerned, Madam Chair, about the vagueness and the long timelines and the fact that Xcel doesn't really make that decision.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think one of the important things for us to remember as the Tax Committee, and we talk about the transparency of the rate structure, is that there are a lot of items that go into the development of the rates that are eventually either approved or disproved by the PUC. And quite frankly, the transparency of any of those items is not necessarily any more clear to us or the public than the tax savings, because the tax savings that for this particular decommissioning account is just one item in a multitude of items that eventually go into the rate. The only thing that is truly transparent is the fact that if there's $9.3 to $8.2 million a year less being paid in taxes and allowed to stay in the fund, that means that that's less money that the ratepayers have to pay to keep that fund adequately funded. And so I don't know that there is a way for any greater transparency to be given to this amount within that rate structure than any of the other items of cost. And so to transparency of this particular item, I don't think should be of great concern to us, because at the end of the day, it's the total cost that the company is incurring that's going to go determine the rate that PUC is eventually going to approve or not approve.
You don't need to comment, Mr. Pearson. I think he was just making some observations. Are there any other questions or comments. I would note, Senator Pratt and Mr. Pearson, that I found the article and, in the paper a few weeks ago about the, looks like to me, a very exciting opportunity for the Becker property. And we will, I think all of us are very interested in following the course of action on that, on how that is eventually developed, and wish you well with that project.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
I do want to ask Ms. Bears if she would comment on the difference, Senator Pratt, in, if it's just a, she's coming right up now, difference in the revenue estimate that you noted in your experience has changed, and what the timing on that was, and why this one, what it was previously, Ms. Bears, and what changed to make the 2025 impact 9.3 million. Ms. Bears.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joanna Bears. I'm the legislative director at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I do not have the old estimate in front of me, but I can tell you what changed is that updated data on the size of their investment holdings was the reason for the change.
Okay, that's perfectly understandable. Just needed to have you say that. Thank you very much, Senator Pratt, Mr. Pearson, and Senate File 1119 will be laid over.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
As amended. The next is Senator Gustafson, Senate File 3368. This, there are no amendments. Senator Gustafson, I would like for you to take us through the bill section by section, if you will, and then we'll turn to your testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The economic and financial abuse of survivors of domestic violence is all too prevalent. It occurs in nearly all instances of domestic violence. Last year, I was proud to carry the coerced debt bill. It's a bipartisan piece of legislation that provides survivors of domestic violence a path to get out from under debt that was forced upon them by their abusers. Under the bill, a survivor who can show a debt was coerced and involuntarily incurred can ask a court for a declaratory judgment that the debt should be extinguished. Minnesota is now one of only four states that offers this critical protection against it. But after the bill became law, it occurred to us that such canceled debt might carry with it a tax consequence. That would be an unfortunate and unintended consequence of the landmark legislation. The law just went into effect January 1st, 2024, so it's too early to tell whether such an unwanted consequence is a good law, of this good law will occur, but we wanted to get ahead of this before the problem becomes a problem for survivors. With the extraordinary compassion, as always, top-notch technical assistance of the Minnesota Department of Revenue staff, the bill before you provides that any debt discharged as a result of the judicial decree would not be subject to taxation in Minnesota as canceled debt. The bill also provides that such canceled debt would not count as income for renters' credit purposes. A similar bill has been drafted with the help of the IRS and is expected to be introduced soon by Congress by Senator Tina Smith and Senator John Cornyn of Texas, another state with a law similar to that which we passed unanimously through all the committees last year. To walk you through the bill.
Thank you.
Section 1 is the discharges of indebtedness or coerced debt, provides the subtraction of the amount of discharge of indebtedness resulting from coerced debt for purposes
and 332.74 is what section of law? It refers to that coerced debt itself. Is that right in lines 111, 112? The cross-reference there. I need to ask the author. What does it refer to?
This is the section where the coerced debt exists. Yes,
thank you, Madam Chair. That is where that the section that you're speaking of is where that's noted. It adds the discharge and the items subtracted for the taxable income and statute.
Okay. Okay, continue, section two.
Section two creates a new definition of combined exemption amount for dependents for purposes of calculating the renter's debt. The new definition is necessary because under the current law, which was just enforced, the definition of income for the renter's credit includes the exemption amounts. Section three is about income. It provides that the amount of discharge and indebtedness resulting from Corus debt shall not be considered income for purposes of determining eligibility for property tax program, or refund program, excuse me.
So, Senator Gustafson, it's included or it's excluded?
Should be excluded.
Excluded, ma'am,
excluded,
or Madam Chair.
In terms of calculating the renter's credit. That, I think, I mean, that's, to me, the thrust of your bill.
Correct. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So it doesn't penalize someone for having this forgiveness of debt in their eligibility for the renter's credit, right?
That's exactly right.
Yes, right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I think that's it. Mr. Elwood, if you would identify yourself for the record, we're pleased to have your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I just want to thank Senator Gustafson for carrying this bill, and really great thanks to Ms. Bayers and the Department of Revenue for helping us craft this this bill and all the technical assistance they provided. Here for any questions and appreciate your support for the bill.
Any questions? Thank you very much, Senator Gustafson. Mr. Elwood, it's a very thoughtful bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Senate File 3368 will be laid over. The next bill that we have is Senate File 2509. There is an A1 amendment. Senator Klein, this is your first stop. Senator Klein moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Klein, to explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair Rest and members, for hearing Senate File 2509, which creates a solution for the unique situation faced by my constituent city, South St. Paul, a city where the school district boundaries match precisely the city boundaries. And there is a paucity of commercial taxation base or large retail. So that property taxes do not fully fund the school district in comparison to adjacent communities where there's a much larger commercial base. The correct solution to this statewide, the global solution to communities that are facing this circumstance would be levy equalization, which is a concept this committee has considered in the past. But you've given me the grace of hearing this bill to try to create a single solution, a smaller solution for my unique circumstance of South St. Paul. I'm grateful for the hearing, and I have two testifiers, Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Whoever's going to speak first, if you'd identify yourself for the record, we welcome your testimony.
Thank you. My name is John Roche. I am Chair of the South St. Paul School Board. I want to thank the Senate Taxation Committee, Mr. Klein, for advocating for our community. South St. Paul is a small but mighty community that is just 5.5 miles south of where we sit today. We are a small and aging community that is still recovering from major historical industries having left our town. Like many of the school districts facing financial needs, we asked our community for considering a learning levy this last election season. Our community voted to support our schools, and I have a great deal of gratitude for our community having done so. Had this not passed, our school districts would have faced rather significant cuts and adversely impacted our kids. Our community truly supported the ability to provide high-quality education for our future generations. With this increased tax burden, we are facing incredible sort of tax burden that is different than that of our surrounding communities. With a very small amount of commercial business properties in our community, the tax impact is incredibly high directly on our homeowners. Our district partners with West St. Paul and on programming like community education and career and technical education for our high schools, and they have been great partners. But as the handout shows, you can see how much more value our neighboring communities get for their taxes because of their much larger commercial corridors. And that is why our taxpayers are hurting. To generate the same amount of revenue for our students in our schools in South St. Paul, our community pays about three times more than that of all of our direct neighbors. With this aging community, many on fixed incomes, we are hearing over and over again that our citizens' tax burden is truly hurting and forcing them to make some really challenging decisions. For over 12 years, we've made a lot of pleas around this. Equalization has been one of them. We've gone to the Education Committee. We have also sort of lobbied within tax communities as well. And each time, we're sort of pointed in the other direction of which direction to go to advocate for this. And we have found that really frustrating. And I think we've done that for about 12 to 14 years now. Today, you have the opportunity to help solve a long-standing inequity that affects our very small community. We feel strongly that this is an equity issue related to property taxes and desperately need some relief. And I want to thank you for your consideration today.
Good morning. Brian Zambrino. I'm the superintendent of South St. Paul Public Schools, and I think Senator Klein and our chair, board chair, Rosh, have kind of covered it well, but you know, coming in, we were well supported by the ESSER dollars, the federal relief funds that are ending this year, and so our taxpayers, our community stepped up and supported our school district, but more and more I'm hearing people saying, I'm about to be priced out of my home. And so there's some buyer's remorse, which I don't think they really feel, but they're hurting. And so it's a really tough spot to be in between feeling like supporting your schools and keeping your community thriving and vibrant. Without a strong public school system, I don't think any community can thrive or succeed. And so they stepped up, they gave us those dollars, but because of the system that is currently in place, we mentioned equalization, that used to work, that used to help. That is no longer really an effective tool. And so that's why Senator Klein is brought this bill before you. So I just thank you so much for this time and hope that today's the day. This community has come year after year after year and they're hurting. And we have an aging, as Chair Rosh mentioned, our community is aging. Lots of retired folks on fixed incomes who want to see this community thrive. There were two meatpacking plants that provided great benefit to the broader community of Minnesota. Many surrounding communities benefited and prospered as a result of those two meatpacking plants. Those Swift and Armour have been gone for a while. The community's aged but stayed there because they love the community, and now we're really struggling. So we thank you so much for this opportunity to be here and hope that today is the day to create some equity for our small but mighty little community.
Thank you very much. Senator Weber first, and then Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for Senator Klein or anyone else can answer it. I mean, I have great sympathy for communities with low property values to pay for things. If you represent a rural district, you have a lot of that occurs. My question is, if we open this door, do we have an idea of how many other communities, how many other districts might qualify for this and all of a sudden wind up with something much greater than $230,000 of credit that the state has to reimburse?
Senator Klein.
Madam Chair, there's a special provision in federal law that really applies only to the community of South St. Paul. It was certified in the Economic Development Act of 1956. As a city of the second class designated as a redevelopment area. So with the language of the bill as it exists, this does not open up any doors. The broader philosophical question as to are there other communities in a similar situation which could benefit from similar support, that is absolutely a door that needs to be discussed, but I'm here today advocating on behalf of the community I represent.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was kind of a similar line, only thinking about that equalization, I think we have three levels of education equalization, and I'm just wondering why that's not meeting the need, and then kind of to, so my thought is, why not change the equalization formulas or new formula if that's what's needed? Because as noted, while the federal law might have specified just this one entity, we know that in, as you noted, Senator Klein, in this body, we will say, well, we need to treat like things alike. And so this was for this particular community. Why would we not do something for a very similarly situated community in a very similar state? So my question is, what is preventing you from working? I know these formulas are difficult. I know the equalization formulas are difficult, but we have revised them over the years, and I just want to know why this would not be going through the education equalization revision process.
Senator Klein.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, so I think I'm a co-author on a statewide equalization bill, and I continue to support that concept. Typically, the equalization aid, while it helps communities with low commercial base like South St. Paul, it at the same time holds harmless other communities so that the one community doesn't benefit from a gain by losing from the adjacent community. And that entails a large fiscal impact to the state. And in the current, you know, tax environment and revenue environment, that is unlikely to have a path that this year. So I guess that's why I'm bringing forward this specific provision. We do have a revenue estimate that estimates it with the cost to the state would be $230,000 going forward.
Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for the for that piece of, I guess, math, actually. And then I think the other question, too, I believe you mentioned the ESSER funds that you're, that maybe this, the dollars are needed to replace the vanishing, you know, one-time ESSER funds. Do you know what those were used for? Were they used for not just one-time expenses, or were they used for ongoing expenses? That is a challenge, using one-time dollars for ongoing
Correct.
Expenses.
Yeah, so I...
you need to address the
Madam Chair, excuse me, I apologize.
That's fine.
With all due respect. Senator Nelson, I am newer to the district, so I did not make the decisions on how those funds were used. I can share that it was a mix of some of the ongoing costs and new costs. I mean, one of the challenges when you allocate money to a school district and say, don't use this for ongoing costs, 80% of our money is spent on human capital. And so there's not a great way, like, what else would you spend it on than educators, support staff, other folks? And so that's what a lot of districts did. We resolved that through our operating referendum. And so the community has supported and funded the position. So we're able to sustain all of our programming and everything that we had in place when I started, but that's a real challenge. I know many districts, you'll see some budget projections coming through the Association of Metropolitan School District, where many districts are in a really tough situation. Our situation that we're asking for today is not specifically more funding for education, which I think is what you're gonna hear from superintendents and other groups. We're just looking for support for our property taxpayers. So this isn't gonna put money in our account, it's really to help support our taxpayers.
Senator Drzewskowski. Oh, Senator Nelson.
Just a final comment.
Sure.
It seems like, so you're not alone in this issue, this problem, but it looks like there's maybe two routes that folks are choosing. One is go to the voters for a referendum, which is what you're trying to avoid, or come to the state for that additional help. So I think it's I guess it's just a bit of a conundrum because there are so many communities that don't have a commercial tax base. And we must not lose sight of the fact that it is the commercial tax base that is so valuable in particularly funding our schools and our property taxes. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Senator Drzewskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had the same kind of question as Senator Nelson about the use of ESSER funds. Dr. Zambrino, I mean, could you characterize, I mean, a couple of things. Where is your student enrollment at now compared to prior COVID? And any idea what you're paying per student now versus then?
Yeah, so our...
Because obviously school districts are on the plane and governments operate all the time. They get this infusion of money and it's supposed to be one time and their ability to adjust downward is not very well documented. So I'd be interested in those.
Superintendent.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator, yeah, we are facing declining enrollment largely because of birth rates. And so one of the challenges many districts are facing, I know there's a conversation around declining birth rates, I'm sorry, declining enrollment as a result of the pandemic. We had an enrollment study done by an outside entity, and the largest driver of our declining enrollment is birth rates. So we're graduating in class of around 250 kids in our incoming. So 5 years ago, the birth rate in our community was 185 births. So when we look at our incoming kindergarten population, that's the maximum number we can hit. So each year we're graduating a class that's larger than our incoming freshman class. The reason why the per pupil cost continues to rise is the cost of doing business is rising faster than funding. So we are so thankful for the funding we received as a school district last year. You hear about the 4% and 2%. That is on half of our revenue. So when you actually do the math on that, it's 2% and 1%. And then we have a rising cost for heating and gas and transportation, and every cost that we're incurring, insurance, is it going much faster than the rate of revenue. So we are working diligently to be fiscally responsible. But that is our challenge, is that the costs continue to outpace funding. If that answers your question, I'm not sure if that got to what you were.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
Senator Dr. Zabrin.
Yes, the other testifier wanted to contribute as well, Madam Chair.
Certainly, sir.
I also want to sort of add testimony to the characterization of our ESSER funds.
You do need to address the chair, sorry.
Madam Chair, apologies. The vast majority of our ESSER funds did go to single cost items that increased and incurred upon the district during the pandemic, and additional funding models that needed to occur. And so I want to make sure that much of that characterization is, yes, we had increased influx of funding with those ESSER funds. Most of those went into single one-time items. It is simply some of this declining enrollment and the increased cost of the districts that has led to us proceeding for the learning levy.
Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, and members, we're seeing this around the state. I see it in a larger city next to my district. We have school districts that are experiencing declining enrollment, and there seems to be a denial amongst the school culture within the local unit of government that they need to right-size their schools in order to match the amount of income coming in. And for you guys and gals managing those, I understand the difficulty, but the reality is we have to figure this out, because this is a trend that's happening. Very, very large pickup truck when all the kids have graduated from school. You know, we've got to, it's time to buy a little Toyota truck, a smaller Toyota truck or something. I'm working on the metaphor, Madam Chair, but it's not coming real well. But we don't have the ability, our local units of government aren't having the ability to figure out how to right size. And I know it's difficult, but we have to do it. And we're not doing it. We're not doing it in the community by me. They're in full denial. And they've been in declining enrollment for probably a decade now. And, you know, so we've got a bill before us to ask the property taxpayers or the taxpayers of Minnesota to pay more in districts like this, simply because the district doesn't have the ability to do what it should do, and maybe you need to close some buildings or whatever it might be in order to match the number of kids you have, but it's just not happening. The other question I had, and I know there's Dr. Zambrino would like to talk some more, and I'd certainly like to hear from him, But the other question, while you're collecting your thoughts, Doctor, is unrelated to schools, and it's about tax-exempt properties. And I know we don't have anybody from the city here, but and maybe it's not the case in South St. Paul, but certainly Minneapolis and St. Paul, the number of tax-exempt properties that continue to grow, and more government institutions and other categories of tax exemption. So there's less and less properties to pay the bill. And then that contributes to the problem as well. And I'm wondering if you all have analyzed that at all in your community.
Superintendent Zambrino.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. Senator, in terms of right-sizing, that is something we do. We just had a board meeting, and that is the term we use, and we are doing right-sizing. So we have a formula that we use to allocate staff, as we have, and that's based on the number of students in each site. As our students decline, we are reducing our teachers. So we're looking at potentially 12.6 teacher reductions. We have two elementary schools, one middle school, one high school. And so that's a significant reduction in number of teaching staff, and we continue to make appropriate reductions. And so we are, again, working very diligently to be fiscally responsible. What's before you is support for our taxpayers. Again, this is not asking for additional revenue for the school district. We are looking for support for our taxpayers based on the discrepancies that exist because of how the tax code works. When one community right next door has a large commercial corridor, their taxpayers pay one quarter of the cost. We heard about equalization earlier. Equalization has not been adjusted to keep up with inflation. So there used to be, I apologize, I don't have that specific numbers. There were many districts that qualified for it, and every year more and more drop off. I was told last year there was only one or two districts still that remain receiving the benefit from the current equalization law. We have been here year after year after year here or at the education side asking for equalization to be adjusted, and that just doesn't happen. And so we're looking for some relief for our community. Again, it's not asking for more money for our schools so we don't make those difficult decisions. We are making those difficult decisions, and we have to sit with those teachers and say, we're sorry, we don't have the enrollment, and we'll do that to be fiscally responsible and continue to make those reductions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know that we have, maybe Senator Klein can comment on the question about tax exempt properties in South St. Paul.
Senator Klein.
Madam Chair, Senator Oskowski, I don't have statistics for you, but I can tell you in general terms that it is not a significant portion of the property base in that city. Do you have more information?
Madam Chair, at one point in time, South St. Paul did try a tax-exempt business corridor in place of where our meatpacking plants had closed. That no longer exists inside of our community. There is not a tax-exempt status for any business elements inside our district.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Druskowski. Someone else wants to ask a question? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize. I just need to go over some ground we've already covered.
I'll listen very closely.
I'm still not understanding why equalization aid hasn't worked for you, either, you know, under the current formula and factors, or in making a request to change the formula and factors, or to recognize the unique circumstances.
are others impacted by this. This is just showing what is actual reality. So we had Ehlers, who's our accounting firm, look at us. This is what's playing out in the current context. So right next door, West St. Paul, the taxpayer spends. So if we were to generate $100,000 in revenue, if you look at a $250,000 home, their cost, $3, South St. Paul, $11. So I think this, if anything else, illustrates just how broken the system is around equalization. And we don't want to harm West St. Paul. They're great partners of ours. We partner with them around community education, career and technical education for our high school students. They're great partners. But when they go to their taxpayers who have a similar size operating referendum, they're getting it at a fraction of the cost. And that's what ultimately is a fix that needs to happen. I totally agree. Today, Senator Klein is putting something forward to help our community that's hurting. People are saying they're going to lose their homes.
All right. So,
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, I didn't hear an answer to my question, though. I understand this case that you're making for South St. Paul.
Sure.
What has happened with the statewide effort that has been led by organizations like C? Has this legislature simply not responded to that effort,
sure,
or have they just not responded in a way that helps?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator, thank you. We have testified and advocating for that year after year after year, and it has never been moved forward in a way that has allowed it to happen.
Thank
and
you.
So if equalization is the answer, we will be eager and excited to have that happen. But after, you know, I think they say doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different outcomes at some point, I don't know that that's truly the definition of an insanity, but I can tell you it leads to great and deep frustration when you come here and testify year after year. Dr. Dave Webb, who was before me, was here. Seed has been here. Other districts, you know, we're trying our best, and we're looking for relief for our community because they're hurting, and they need that relief, and they deserve that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief, but the challenge is, as you've noted, and well, first I applaud the fact that you're very interested in making sure your kids have excellent schools. But the challenge, as you've stated, is that you just don't have enough commercial property, which does have the highest property tax rates. At least that's what your document says, that you're being penalized because your community has more residential property than commercial property. And so that's how our property tax system works. Commercials properties pay, I think, the highest taxation, property taxation. So the question, it begs the question, not necessarily part of the tax committee here, but looking at the problem, trying to see what's the issue. Why is it that St. Paul is not able to have a healthy, competitive commercial tax base? Because that would impact your schools in the way that you're seeking.
Senator Madam Klein. Chair, I can probably take that one better than the superintendent. So South St. Paul is a very original city in the state, one of the first cities on the Mississippi River border. It is landlocked. It has an aging housing base, and that is predominantly what exists in South St. Paul, houses of people of all ages. And as that housing stock ages, this is the situation we are faced with. So it is not a Robert Street where there's a super target. There's no really space or opportunity to create that. The city has been innovative in trying to, you know, cultivate and attract businesses, and will continue to do that work. But as of right now, that does not exist.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, ma'am. And just to follow up, that understand those realities, but that's also what local government aid looks at. So local government aid looks at those old housing stock, for example, and many of the things that you mentioned. And so when we look at these things, and they're essential, but it's important to get the whole picture, and how does LGA fit into this property tax issue as well. So I don't expect an answer today, but I think it's something that needs to be considered in the big picture.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Senator Klein and gentlemen, a personal observation about South St. Paul. I may have told this story before. Some 70 years ago, my father, who was with Swift & Company, you're shaking your heads, was offered a transfer to South St. Paul. And as is the case in most Southern families, We are from Virginia. My mother said, no, we're not going to the frozen north. And lucky for her and my dad, less than a year later, my father was offered a transfer to New Orleans. And my mother said, I'm packing right now. And that experience of living there certainly has led me to have to sponsor with Senator Kent an annual celebration of Mardi Gras. And so I have a fond non-memory, if you were, of what would it have been like if my mom had said yes, and when I was a little girl, we had become Minnesotans. So I have a great deal of respect for the history of your city and the struggles that it has gone through since the meatpackers left, and what the city has tried to do to recoup the commercial value, industrial value there, and admire their courage in doing so. So thank you very much, gentlemen, and Senator Klein. And Senate File 2509 is laid over as amended.
Thank you very much.
Senator Klein, you have the next bill. That is Senate File 3337.
Madam Chair and Committee, thank you for hearing Senate File 3337. I offer the A1 as an author's amendment.
Senator Klein has the A1 amendment. It's an author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion prevails, and the A1 amendment to Senate File 3337 is adopted. Senator Klein, Senate
File 3337. And thank you. And you should have in your packet a revenue estimate for Senate File 3337 as amended, estimating annual ongoing costs of $10,000 to the revenues per year. A very simple bill which places Foreign Service pension income in the same category as military pension and other income, and makes it a subtraction from income taxation. And Madam Chair, I have testifiers.
Thank you very much. Glancing back at the bill itself, the operative language is in section 1, lines 1 through 10. Otherwise, there's just an effective date that is given. Sir, if you'd identify yourself for the record. We're pleased to have your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Mark Jorgensen. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on this issue. And thank you to Senator Klein for his assistance in carrying this bill. I'm a Minnesota native. I was born and grew up in Marshall, Minnesota. I did my undergraduate degree at Hamline and my graduate work at St. Thomas. I retired as a U.S. Foreign Service Officer, or FSO, in November of 2021 after I was kicked out of Belarus by President Lukashenko. Wear that as a badge of honor. I retired after 24 years of service with the government, 19 of those years serving at different U.S. embassies outside the United States. I served tours in Russia, Malaysia, South Korea, Uzbekistan, Senegal, Moldova, and finally Belarus, and also did many temporary assignments in many different countries, ranging from a few days at a time up to 54 weeks. Even as a member of the U.S. Foreign Service, my wife Susan and I continued to maintain our Minnesota residency. My wife, also a Minnesota native, and I decided to retire in Minnesota because it offers us the lifestyle we enjoy. Great outdoors, and to be honest, four seasons, although this winter has been a little bit tough for that. I'm here today to ask you to consider providing the same tax treatment, an income subtraction, to the Foreign Service pension as you do to the military pension received by many Minnesota residents. I'm in no way saying that serving in the Foreign Service is directly comparable to serving in the U.S. military. However, there are many similarities, and we face many of the same challenges. Foreign Service officers serve in both war zones and hotspots, many times directly beside our military colleagues. There are currently Foreign Service officers stationed in many war zones and hotspots across the world today: Ukraine, Sudan, Ethiopia, Haiti, Myanmar, Azerbaijan, Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso, just to name a few of those. In addition, Foreign Service officers routinely serve in other hostile, dangerous, and unhealthy countries in the world. I personally served in Russia, where not only me, but my wife were surveilled 24/7, had our apartment routinely entered, which was also bugged and videoed, and had our car damaged on a routine basis, all by local government security organizations. In addition to chronic medical issues within my family picked up while serving outside the United States, I have Foreign Service officer friends that have had very serious medical issues that were life-threatening and dangerous while posted in faraway places. In fact, one close friend needed to have his leg amputated because for several days he was unable to get a flight out of or a medevac flight into his country of assignment, where medical care, needless to say, was less than good. I've had good friends who required disability retirements because they sustained physical injuries from IEDs and mortars while serving in war zones. Several Foreign Service posts around the world, in addition to the standard emergency radio being issued upon arrival, also issues body armor and Kevlar helmets. Since 1980 alone, more than 100 Foreign Service officers have been killed in the line of duty, including many in targeted bombings and shootings, as U.S. embassies have become targets for terrorists, drug lords, and anyone holding anti-American sentiments. As FSOs, we routinely, like members of the military, move around the world, usually every 2 or 3 years. And we're moving around the world, not just to a different military base in the United States. As you can imagine, this puts significant stress and strain on our spouses or partners and other family members. Spouses or partners have a difficult time, at best, maintaining a career under these conditions. And if they are able to work, they're usually left either applying for extremely limited positions within the embassy, and rarely the same position from post to post, or trying to maintain a business relationship from across the world. As an example, my wife Susan followed me around the world, and as a result was only able to work intermittently, although not by choice, in the limited number of contract positions available at the embassies we served at. She now relies on my Foreign Service pension because her Social Security earnings and benefits were limited, as she was unable to work and pursue a career and accrue the financial benefits that go along with having a career. And like the military, the Foreign Service regularly assigns Foreign Service officers to one of the many posts that are now unaccompanied, splitting spouses or partners and family members who cannot go to the post while the Foreign Service officer undertakes their tour of duty. So while I can't and won't directly equate the challenges of Foreign Service life with our esteemed colleagues in the military, Foreign Service officers, their spouses or partners, and their family members face many of the same issues that military members and their spouses or partners and families face as a result of serving our country. I know that there's a revenue estimate here. I think that's relatively new, so I think you have that information. I guess, Madam Chair, I'd like to thank you for the time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, sir. Did you want to testify as well?
Yes, Madam Chair.
If you'd state your name for the record.
Yes. My name is Carl Olson, and I live in St. Louis Park. And I just have a brief additional information. I'm a second-generation Minnesotan. My father is from northwestern Wisconsin, my mother from northwestern Ontario, and they worked and studied and lived in Minnesota for many years in the 1950s. Then they pursued other opportunities and wound up in the Washington, D.C. area. And so when I joined the Foreign Service in 1985, and I served for 30 years, everyone assumed that I was from Minnesota. And my parents returned here in 2018, and I moved here in 2021, and I finally made it official. And I even like lutefisk. But I worked a lot with our military in Iraq, including in Iraq and Afghanistan, where I was embedded with them in each case for over a year. Shana bashana is a Dari term for shoulder to shoulder. And I found that I was able to influence and help them to be successful because I could see things that my uniformed colleagues could not.
Thank you very much, sir. Are there questions or comments for Senator Klein or his testifiers? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of information. I noticed, according to the information from the department, that this applies to Foreign Service officers hired after 1984. What is the significance of the 1984 date?
Senator Klein.
Madam Chair. The federal pension system changed in 1984.
Okay.
There was an older system that did not incorporate Social Security, and the new one does.
Okay. All right, very good. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Then Senate File 3337 is laid over as amended. Thank you very much, Senator Klein and General.
Appreciate your service.
The next bill is Senate File 1155. This bill was heard last year in committee, and the policy was included in the omnibus bill, so it has been heard in the committee and laid on the table. So Senator Weber moves that Senate File 1155 be taken from the table. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion prevails, and the bill is before us. Senator Weber moves now the A3 amendment. This is not its first hearing, so Senator Weber, going to ask you to explain what happens with the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, one of the problems that was cited by the department after this bill was passed last year dealt with the and what the Short Line Railroad Association determined would be a problem was the transferability of this credit. And the department maintained that how the bill was written required that they would have to be the following tax year, whereas the intent was to allow transferability in the year that the credit was earned. And so Ms. Pollack, together with the department, worked on the appropriate language, which is what forms Amendment A3 amendment. And so it also provides that that this can be transferred within the year that it's earned. And it also requires that there be a certificate from the Commissioner of Transportation that this work did indeed occur. And at that point, that's why today I think we have to refer it to the Transportation Committee to be heard as well. But Anyway, this does allow for that credit then to be transferred in the year that it was earned. And I imagine, Ms. Pollack, if you have any additional comments concerning the language.
Ms. Pollack?
Madam Chair, Senator Weber, no, I would have nothing further to add unless members have questions.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I also have with me today Ryan Pitty, who is here to express his support. He works with many short line railroads across the country, and if you would like to hear from him as well.
Ms. Pitty, Mr. Pitty.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ryan Pitty with Mickelson and Company, and we work with many of the short line railroads in the state of Minnesota and also across the country, helping them finance infrastructure improvement work.
Would you just remind the members what the definition of a short line railroad is?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Short line railroads are your small rural branch lines that really connect a lot of your rural ag shippers and manufacturers to the national freight network. There are Class 1 railroads, which you'll read about in the financial press, which would be the Canadian Pacific, the Burlington Northern, et cetera. And these short lines are these 550 smaller railroads across the country. There are 17 short line railroads in the state of Minnesota, comprising 1,500 track miles, but these are the small local operators that are providing critical transportation services to producers and manufacturers in the state. Railroading is capital intensive. It can cost upwards of $20,000 a mile annually just to maintain track. If you're gonna build new track, like an industrial spur, you know, sort of an off-ramp to get to a new customer, that's could be up to $3 million a mile. So the original intent of the legislation that we're thankful the legislature passed last year is to help spur additional track work. Some of these are small operators, and the fact that there's a transferability component within the legislation is really used to finance more track work, fix bridges, fix crossings, et cetera. And so this change would allow the railroads to transfer this tax credit to a customer or a vendor, et cetera, somebody they do business with, but it's more related to the timing element of it. The intent would be to conclude the taxable year, identify how much of a credit's earned, and then transfer it. When it got rolled into the tax package, the interpretation from the Department of Revenue based on how the bill ended up getting written was that a railroad must file their tax return first to determine how much of the credit's unused, which ultimately ends up diluting the effectiveness of the mechanism to fund additional track work. And so really, this change helps conform with how 10 other states administer similar type of programs, and ultimately will help the railroads reinvest at more of an accelerated rate to ultimately help their customers get product to market. So happy to answer any questions, but really this is it's a cleanup, and there isn't a cost associated, at least from our viewpoint. It just makes the program work more efficiently and effectively. And we did have a number of conversations with the Department of Revenue, Ms. Pollack, and others to figure out how this could work the best way for better utilization for the short line community.
Thank you very much. I really was trying to get at short line railroad, that we call it that, has nothing to do with the number of miles of track. It has to do with the revenues that are come into and the limitations on the revenues to be called considered a short line railroad. So it's not just, you know, 25 miles or less or 50 miles or less. It's a term of art and does not refer to that.
And Madam Chair.
Mr. Weber, Senator Weber.
One of the things I think is important to remember too is that the short line railroads basically developed when the reorganization of the railroad system in the country created the abandonment of many of the rural, shorter distanced rail lines. And these the short line companies basically developed to keep the system operating to provide a service to the businesses along the tracks and in those communities. And so the short line railroad industry probably was like 40 to 50 years ago that much of the development of these rail systems
and happened. They're all over the country.
Yes,
they
are.
They're all over the country.
Yeah.
Any questions or comments for Senator Weber or his testifier? Seeing none, Senate File 1155. Oh, I'm sorry, we didn't adopt the amendment. Senator Weber moves adoption of the A3 amendment. Discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have the bill in front of us. Senator Weber, we are going to lay Senate File 11. What? Yes, I know. We're not going to lay it over. Senator Weber moves that Senate File 1155 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Transportation. Senator, because there is the assumption of a fiscal impact, not the revenue estimate, but a fiscal impact, the Tax Committee wants the Transportation Committee has taken it up, will ask for the bill to be returned to the Tax Committee for us to deal with it later. Any questions or comments on the Weber motion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator.
Okay. Senator Putnam. Senator Putnam's bill is will receive similar treatment that, in part, that Senator Weber's bill did. We have before us Senator, well, we don't have before us Senator Putnam. We don't have Senate File 1242. Senator Putnam moves that Senate File 1242 be taken from the table. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say no. The motion prevails. Senate File 1242 is before us. Senator Putnam now moves his A3 amendment. It's the same situation as before. It's not an author's amendment. The bill has been before the committee before, so you need to explain the A3 amendment before we vote on it.
Madam Chair, the A3 amendment is a result of conversations between the Department of Revenue and the MREA, and this is the language that they agreed upon as the most appropriate way of moving forward. There are some very modest changes in the changes that we offered prior.
Will you explain them, however?
Madam Chair, the A3 amendment basically makes two interventions in the prior bill. One, it changes the lines, the language that we see on several parts in the bill from appurtenances and attachments and appurtenances to systems not including substations or transmission generation equipment. So it's that change in language. And then it's the inclusion of an effective date.
And Senator Putnam, that change comes about because attachments and appurtenances is a very antiquated description of these systems and really has no meaning left in it. But it has been litigated over and over and over again, and now the time has come to set it aside and actually modernize the system and how and how these items are treated under the law.
Madam Chair, indeed, that's the rationale is this change in technology and enforcement. And
thank you, Senator Putnam. Are there comments or questions on the A3 amendment? And Ms. Glumak, did you want to testify? If there are none, I don't see any. Did you have a comment?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you very much. Good morning, committee members. Really, I just want to say thank you to Commissioner Marquardt and to you, Madam Chair, for all the conversations that have been had in the interim.
I'm glad they're over.
What's that?
I'm glad they're over.
Yes, me too, Madam Chair. I mean, I think each person, Madam Chair, on this committee has helped with this long-term legislation that we've heard a number of times in this committee. So I really just want to thank all the committee members. Senator Weber, I know you carried this before. Senator Housechild, Senator Nelson, and I could go on and on. So I'm happy to answer any questions. And thank you, Senator Putnam, for finally getting this done. And we hope to get this across the finish line this year.
Anyone else have a comment? We need to adopt the amendment on Senator Putnam's motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. And Senate Final 1242 is laid over.
Thank you.
As amended.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Rest. Senate File 3564 is before the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 3564 is a sales tax exemption for trigger locks. Last year, the Senate Tax Committee put in our omnibus bill a sales tax exemption for storage boxes for weapons, safe boxes, and it was included in the omnibus bill. These are two small steps that the legislature can take that I believe have widespread bipartisan support as incentives for people. I think primarily of parents, of keeping their weapons safe, and that's the same for this one. It's a minor amount, but I believe it is a step that the Senate Tax Committee can take, and the author of the bill in the House is the House Tax Chair, so I'm hopeful that it will be included in our omnibus bills as we go forward. When the bill was being developed, it seemed to be fairly simple. You know, to, I mean, I don't know very much. No, I don't know anything about guns, but I know that there are safety devices, and apparently there are two types with regard to firearms. A trigger lock can be installed as an extra on a weapon, or it can be part of the weapon as it is manufactured. We wanted to make sure that we were only including in the sales tax exemption those that are installed after the gun has been manufactured, to avoid the notion that we were, that the bill would give a sales tax exemption to the purchase of guns themselves, just to those, and the federal law has two classifications of trigger locks that we also discovered. One is installing something that is installed, and the other as part of the firearm. And so we wanted to make sure that we were only including the one. And then, interestingly, or at least to me, there also is a streamline issue. They are currently, they meaning we, I'm on the board and the executive committee, are looking at, you know, we're all about definitions, and the what they don't have, and Ms. Bears, if she's still here, can I think attest to that. There is no formal definition that is has been adopted by Streamline at this point for a trigger lock, and so we're kind of under the radar, if you will, by making this bifurcation of what Minnesota is offering as a sales tax incentive by exempting the installed the installed trigger locks. So that is the bill. It is a minor. I even regret that it's so minor, but it is a minor cost. In fact, you know, I think other than the decommissioning bill, all the bills that we've heard today, we could pass them all for less than $500,000. I mean, really good work, I think, for the tax committee in taking to heart that we're not, even though we're getting a very favorable, comparatively speaking, economic forecast, budget forecast today, that we still need to be extremely cautious in our with fiscal responsibility for spending. But with the bills that we've heard, we can pay more attention to the policy rather than the cost. So I don't have any testifiers, but Mr. Chairman, if there are no questions, I would just request that the bill be laid over. But I see Senator Drazkowski.
Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Rest, Madam Chair, for your work on this bill, and thank you for taking the data practices provision from last year when we had that discussion. I read the language again. I think it look at least it appears that that particular part that we have in law, that data practices part that says that a seller shall not disclose or transmit, collect or transmit to any private or public entity any personal data or information about a purchaser resulting from the sale of eligible for the exemption under the subdivision. I think that's good language, but I still am concerned. I don't trust our government very much, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. I wonder if Ms. Bears could answer a question if she's available.
Sure. You You know, Mr. Chairman and Senator Drazkowski.
Senator Rust.
I probably don't either, but not for the same reasons.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Or, I'm sorry, please introduce yourself for the record.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joanna Bears. I am the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Bears. So, Ms. Bears, that language that appears, that's in law, that appears on 1.17 through 1.19 on the bill, is there any other way that the Department of Revenue would gain access to information about individuals who were granted this exemption under law?
Ms. Bears.
Mr. Chair, Senator Drazkowski, you know, even when, not that I can think of as of right now, even when we do audits, we're not necessarily looking at the taxpayer specifically. We're looking at receipts and matching receipts to numbers. So we don't necessarily take in, you know, who bought what purchase. It's about how many were sold within the that business and then matching the numbers to the accounting spreadsheets. So not to my knowledge, you know, I'll go back and check with our folks, but I'm pretty sure that we wouldn't take who purchased what.
Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Bears.
Yeah, Senator, Mr. Chairman, Senator
Chair
Drazkowski, when we developed that provision, which was new last year, with regard to the firearm storage units, we were trying to be very particular about that information or individual information could not be shared under the protection of the data privacy laws.
Senator Hauschild.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Madam Chair. I really like this bill, and I liked last year's bill as well. I can't remember if I told this story, but in my home, my parents' home where I grew up, my stepfather has six guns that are literally on our wall as decoration. You probably wouldn't like that, Madam Chair, but certainly my stepfather does. And the funny thing is he only uses a Cabela's credit card for all of his purchases. So whenever we do anything, use a Cabela credit card because he gets points to then use in East Grand Forks and in Rogers at the Cabela store. So if and when we pass this, and then including last year's bill, I'm going to make sure he gets safety things on his shotguns at home so that they're safe for anybody that's in our home. Thank you.
Additional member questions or comments? Senate File 35604 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Chair Rest, do you have closing comments?
No, we don't, but Mr. Chairman, you may adjourn the committee.
Tax committee is adjourned.